You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor. As the coldest weather in decades blankets the state, we want to help you stay safe. Check WPR.org/weather for timely information on current conditions and what to expect in the days to come. That's WPR.org/weather. Coming up, a new report from the Congressional Budget Office found that the government shutdown took a bite out of the U.S. economy. We'll talk to an economist about the ripple effect that we could all see from the shutdown. Now, we used to live in a world where going on the internet was its own separate special activity. Now we have the internet in our pocket. We don't log on to the internet anymore. We're just there most of the time. And our next guest predicts that we will continue to become even more connected. We're now able to buy more smart internet-connected devices than ever before. Thermostats, outlets, microwaves, crockpots, fitness trackers, dog collars, bathroom scales, even pacemakers. Eventually, it will become difficult to buy an item that isn't internet connected. So this internet interconnected network is what's referred to as the Internet of Things, or IoT for short. And just like computers can be hacked, so can the IoT. And what happens if we live in a future where city streets and highways are all on the same interconnected grid? Could everything go down all at once? Our next guest says there's a lot at stake if we don't do something before we keep moving forward. Bruce Schneier is a security expert who's been writing about security and the internet for his blog since 2004. He's a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. His latest book is called Click Here to Kill Everybody: Security and Survival in a Hyper-Connected World. Bruce, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's nice to be cold again.
Yeah, yes. Isn't it, though? Bruce, it used to be that we'd buy products that had computers in them, but now the products that we buy are changing. I mean, we're buying things that are more like computers that happen to have other functions. So whether it's home appliances or fitness trackers, smart bathroom scales, etc., that connect to our smartphones. And that's what you have and what many people refer to as the Internet of Things. But it's more complex and covers even more territory than that. Can you give us a better idea of what exactly the Internet of Things is?
Exactly is hard because it's changing all the time. But it generally refers to the Internet of Objects. So, you know, you said in your introduction, we're used to visiting the Internet, right? We go to our laptops and log on to the Internet. Or we go into our phone and look at it and browse a web page or send a text message. Internet of Things is the internet of non-screens, of common objects, our car, our refrigerator, our thermostat. You mentioned our pacemaker. These objects, which are connected all the time, and we don't interact with them in the same way, that they are part of our environment. Maybe it is a webcam we use as a baby monitor. And these are, or a smart doorbell. And these are all on the internet. They're going to be much more than the phones and computers. We kind of only have one of each of those. But the objects will have tens and eventually hundreds of these objects in our lives, in our homes, in our work, that are connected to the internet at all times, that are collecting data, processing it, and then making decisions and then acting on it. I mean, right now I live in Minneapolis, I'm in Cambridge, I have a thermostat that I can control from my phone even though I'm half a continent away. Now, which is really valuable right now when I wanna make sure that my pipes aren't gonna freeze, but there's security risks. What happens if that thermostat is hacked and someone turns off the power? I'm looking at a lot of property damage when I get home this weekend.
Now, you say in your book, Bruce, that our concept of the internet is changing, that we don't think of it as logging on anymore. Now, you just shared one example, but can you explain a little bit further as to why that matters?
It changes our relationship. Right, so you have a traditional idea that of your phone, that you go on the internet when you pick it up and you turn it on and you check your Facebook or check your messages or make a Skype call. But in fact, that phone's on the internet constantly. Now, the internet has to know where you are physically, otherwise the phone can't ring. You're getting alerts. So it's this constant connection. somebody's called ubiquitous computing, somebody's called persistent computing, that changes our relationship with computers, right? No longer is it a separate space we visit. It is a constant aspect of our life. And it's worth talking about why this happened. Yeah. So internet connected refrigerator, that's the thing that is the butt of all the jokes, right? It's made fun of on television by talk show hosts. Why would you put your refrigerator on the internet? I mean, why would you care that it knows you're out of milk or has a screen in the front where you can see what's inside? Can't you open the door? This is all kind of dumb. And in fact, for decades, refrigerators had microcontrollers, had computing. But they were always specialized chips designed to be a refrigerator. What changed is now it is cheaper to pull a generic internet-ready tiny computer off the shelf, program it with refrigerator stuff, and put it in the refrigerator. So now it is a computer that keeps things cold. And it comes with the internet. It comes with a microphone. It comes with speakers. It comes with memory. It comes with all of the browsing. So you have all the functionality built in because it was cheaper that way because it came that way. And then manufacturers, whether it's a refrigerator, a car, or a microwave, or a toy, what can we do with it? And this is how we end up with this Internet of Things.
Bruce Schneier joins us. He is a security expert who has been writing about the internet and security for his blog since 2004. He's the author of the latest book entitled Click Here to Kill Everybody, Security and Survival in a Hyper-Connected World. Bruce, you know, one of the things that's beginning to happen and will likely continue to happen is that it's becoming a challenge to find and purchase a product that doesn't offer some type of internet connectivity. Now, you had this problem when you were buying a new car. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this is interesting. I'm trying to buy a new car, and because I'm a security guy, I don't want the internet. And I found that I couldn't find a car that didn't come with connectivity. Not that they didn't exist, but, you know, my wife and I had a list of features and things we wanted out of the car, and we had a short list of models that met our criteria. All of those came with the internet. And I would ask, can you turn this off? And the dealer would look at me like, why would you want to do that? And this is the internetification of these things. Because they're there, because they're ubiquitous, it'll become increasingly hard. I mean, now you can buy a refrigerator without the internet. In 5 years, you probably won't be able to. Not because there's some, you know, evil genius who's trying to make these things internet enabled, because it is just cheaper and easier for the manufacturers to make these internet-connected refrigerators. And then once they do, they now can monitor your usage, they can upsell you features, right? Suddenly it becomes a much more interactive, full-featured device, and manufacturers want that, right? They want to control the aftermarket for your appliances, for your automobile, even your toys or your light bulbs. Yeah, and that's pushing a lot of this internetification. You see it in commercial objects, high-end espresso machines and coffee bars and restaurant equipment, office equipment. You have an office copier, it's on the internet. And these are often used to upsell spare parts and upsell replacements. And it's a lot of control going on here. I mean, we sort of see it in things like the Amazon Echo, right, which wants to be this single hub for your home where you talk to. And you think about it, that's also on all the time. You don't log into your Amazon Echo like you log into your laptop. It's there all times listening, right? Just in case you might want to say something it wants to hear.
Bruce, and not to scare anyone, but I think it's important to talk about, wasn't there an incident a few years ago that there was a car that was hacked because it had the computer systems inside of it a few years ago?
There's been more than one instance of car hacking.
Okay.
The one you're probably thinking of, and actually there's a video on YouTube, it's worth watching. Wired Magazine had a reporter in a car, and two security researchers hacked the car remotely from about 10 miles away. And they did things like, you know, turn on the radio and then turn on the wipers, and then they disabled the brakes. And that's scary.
Yeah.
And
yes,
this was
is.
A vulnerability. The manufacturer had to make a 1.4 million car recall. This was Chrysler. I think it's 2014. To fix this, there are other vulnerabilities. There are researchers looking at airplanes. We worry about remote hacking about airplanes. You know they're on the internet, right? You know, if you fly and you pay the extra $20, you can browse and the internet while you're flying. So we know there is an air-to-ground link of the internet. Boeing and others claim it's not connected to the avionics, and then there's reason not to believe that. We worry about the national power grid, hacking there. I mean, things big and small. If you remember, Dick Cheney famously had the remote features of his pacemaker disabled because we were worried, and the legitimate worry, about foreign assassination over the internet. So these things are still science fiction-y, but they are legitimate concerns.
We're talking with Bruce Schneier, a security expert who's been writing about the internet and security for his blog since 2004. He's a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and his latest book is called Click Here to Kill Everybody, Security and Survival in a Hyper-Connected World. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a few smart devices in your homes? What do you enjoy about them, and what do you worry about? What questions do you have about internet security now and in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner. We're continuing our conversation with Bruce Schneier. He is a security expert who's been writing about the internet and security for his blog since 2004. He's also a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. His latest book is called Click Here to Kill Everybody, Security and Survival in a Hyper-Connected World. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What kind of smart devices do you have in your home? How do they help you? Do you think cybersecurity is something we should be more concerned about? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Now, despite, Bruce, the extreme title of your book, there are some advantages to this Internet of Things. I mean, it isn't all bad.
It's not even close to all bad. I mean, There's some enormous advantages. And my belief is that we're not even beginning to see them. I mean, we can laugh about appliances on the internet. But I think once this interconnected home and office and life gets going, there'll be enormous advantages and things we can't even conceive of yet. I mean, I write about security. I write about the dark side of this. But you know, I don't want to paint myself as someone who says we should not do any of this. Right, we should do this, but in a way that is secure. Well, you go.
I was going to ask you, what are some of the positives or potential positives to a connected world?
That data moves seamlessly. That information about what we're doing goes to places where it can provide value, and we get it back in a way that adds value. Think of a cell phone. A cell phone connects an enormous amount of data about us. It's very powerful. Yet the things we do with it are amazing. And when Steve Jobs, you read his initial writings about the iPhone, he never imagined that it would do all the things it is doing today. And I think even today we can't imagine what will happen when our homes are connected. When in fact, my thermostat is smart enough to get the weather report and know that it has to do with certain things because it's going to be minus 20-something crazy in Minneapolis tonight, and I'm not going to be home, right? And it's going to know all those things and then be able to adjust the temperature so that my pipes don't freeze and I'm conserving energy, right? That sounds really valuable, and that's just one minor thing.
Now, there's still many people who are more comfortable with life before everything was connected. For younger people, it's all they know. But it seems like when the new technology comes along, we as consumers will buy the product. We trust the market with no questions asked. Is that something you see? And because of that, should we be exercising more caution?
So I think we should. Well, a couple of answers. I don't think it is fair to ask consumers to exercise more caution. that we generally believe that the government keeps us safe, right? That we can walk into a restaurant and not have to inspect the kitchen, that we can go to a pharmacy, buy a drug, and know that it's not going to kill us, that we walk into a building and know it's not going to collapse on us, even in an earthquake. And these are all government regulations that makes that happen. I flew here from Minneapolis yesterday, and I did not inspect the airplane. And so similar things have to happen with the Internet of Things. Because this new Internet, because it's cars and planes and medical devices, because it can actually kill you in an extreme, that government needs to step in and ensure that things are safe so consumers can buy and use them in confidence without having to be domain experts in computer security, in medical devices, in any of those subject matters, just like the rest of the world. And that's really what's missing. And I think that's going to naturally change, because as computers start becoming not about data but about flesh and blood and concrete and steel, that government regulates dangerous things. It does.
Well, one of the reasons why I asked the question, Bruce, is because there are some who believe, like with some phones that have fingerprint recognition, or there's some tablets that have facial recognition, and there are people who believe that that information goes straight to the government and that you shouldn't have it. So what do you say to those folks who believe that?
Well, they're both right and wrong. It doesn't go straight to the government. It goes straight to Apple. It goes straight to Facebook. It goes straight to Google. It goes straight to these mega corporations. Mm-hmm. And then when the government wants it, they ask those corporations. Right? This is different than China, where it actually does go straight to the government. But in the United States, we have this one step removed. Doesn't make it any better. Doesn't mean we should worry about it less. But we don't really have this tight government corporate integration that you'll see in other societies. And yes, that is worrisome. The fact that Facebook and Google are able to collect this data without our knowledge and consent, use it for whatever they want, is very dangerous, even without government sharing.
Now, the whole point of your book is to let us know that we do not have enough internet security systems in place. So let's get into that for a minute. How are we used to maintaining security in our systems? I mean, why won't that be enough in the Internet of Things?
Well, it hasn't been enough yet, so it's not going to change, right? I mean, and you know this when you read the papers. So, right, it's in the papers this week, a security bug in Apple FaceTime, where someone can eavesdrop on what's going on in a room before the recipient picks up the call. I mean, that is just one of many. I mean, and those things happen every week, right? It's a data breach at Marriott Hotels a month ago, and next week it'll be something else. So, right, internet security isn't working very well. Right? The Chinese steal data from the U.S. government. The Russians hack our power plants. This all hits the news. So what's different is most of the time it's about data. Right? You know, Facebook eavesdrops on what's going on. It's data. And someone hacks into Yahoo and steals a bunch of customer data, or Equifax. It's data. It's personal, but it's data. What's changing is that now the internet will affect the world in a direct physical manner. If my thermostat gets hacked, I don't care if they get my data. I care if they shut it off, because it's going to be freezing tonight. And if they shut it off, that's property damage. Now, Dick Cheney wasn't worried that the Russians would hack his heart monitor and get data. They were worried they would deliver a lethal shock that would kill him. And that's the change. And that, I think, is going to spur government to get involved.
Right now, there are some big agencies and companies who benefit from insecurity. And you wrote a whole chapter in this in your book that Google wants us to have security just as long as it can gather our data and sell ads. And, I mean, that's just one example. Can you we have a couple of minutes, but I wanted to ask you, can you tell us a little bit more about surveillance capitalism?
So surveillance capitalism is the business model of the internet. Right? This is how companies make money. In the modern era, they collect and monetize our data, sometimes by selling it, sometimes in the case of the big companies like Facebook and Google, selling access to it, not selling it directly. But, our cell phone companies, the websites we visit, the apps we use, and increasingly, these objects in our environment collect and sell data. Well, we know that Roomba, The robot vacuum cleaner collects data about the size and shape of your house based on it, like, scurrying around vacuuming, and sells that data.
Wow.
And this is the modern economy. Surveillance capitalism is a term. Shoshana Zuboff, professor here at Harvard, has a new book on surveillance capitalism, really worth reading. And this is the business model, and it also fosters control. Once Roomba knows how often you use it, how dirty your floors are, it could, you know, try to sell you a better model. It knows when you're making this up, when your vacuum cleaner bag is full and you need to buy more supplies. And so this kind of monitoring goes hand in hand with control. And you see it in farm equipment. John Deere does a lot of monitoring when farmers buy and use John Deere equipment. And it sells that data back to the farmers.
Last question. We have about 30 seconds left, but I wanted to ask you, do you think we will wake up and realize our vulnerabilities in a connected world?
I go back and forth. My fear is it will take a disaster. Right? My title of my book is the kind of fanciful click here to kill everybody. It's not going to be everybody. But I worry that it will be a disaster with cars that causes a few thousand of them to crash, or a disaster with medical devices, that I think we will wake up, but it will take something of that magnitude to do it. My hope is we can do better policy before there's a disaster. I think we are better as society if we are proactive, but generally we tend to be reactive. We tend not to fix something until it's really obvious that it's broken.
Bruce, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. This was fun. Enjoy your cold weather.
Thank you. Take care. That was Bruce Schneier, a security expert who's been writing about the internet and security for his blog since 2004. His latest book is called Click Here to Kill Everybody, Security and Survival in a Hyperconnected World. Coming up, we'll talk about the effects that the recent government shutdown has had on the economy. I'm Darrell Conner. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, across the country, states are grappling with questions over redistricting and looking for ways to stop partisan gerrymandering. Kate Archer Kent talked with a political scientist who says it's harder to correct than it might seem. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the partial government shutdown came to an end on Friday after President Trump and congressional leaders reached a short-term agreement to get federal employees back to work. That shutdown was the longest in U.S. history, and it kept hundreds of thousands of workers off the job or working without pay for more than a month. And while the political fallout has yet to be fully understood, we already have a sense of the impact that the shutdown had on the U.S. economy. According to a new report from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the shutdown cost the economy $11 billion and a $3 billion permanent loss. Our next guest is here to put those numbers into perspective and talk about how the economy might fare moving forward. Michael Carroll is a professor and the director of Economics Research Group at the University of North Texas. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us. In our introduction, Michael, we gave a brief rundown of the CBO report, namely that the shutdown cost the economy $11 billion. What does that actually look like?
I think that's probably not unrealistic. The report says it's $11 billion, but $8 billion will be made up after the workers get paid. So essentially it's a net of $3 billion, which I think that's actually a little bit low. I'm not too sure if all of that $8 will be recouped right away just because of the way people spend their money. And I think also the potential of an additional shutdown here in a few more weeks may change how the workers do spend their money when they get it.
What factors does the Congressional Budget Office consider when making that estimation?
I think they look at just the wage pool. You know, they know how much workers were going to be made, and then they know essentially what percentage of the pay, you know, a person's paycheck do they spend. Obviously, they can't spend their entire net amount because they have to pay taxes and all of that kind of thing. So they actually estimate essentially what people generally spend their money on. So they calculate a basket of goods and do it some other ways. But for the most part, they're trying to measure consumption.
So with the broader picture of the economy, how much of an impact does that dollar amount have?
I think if you look at it for a year, you know, if you're looking at the 2019 economy, it's really not going to be that much in terms of just the economy as a whole. Now, obviously, there's you know, household concerns, and that may have been a large impact because you just don't know what they were spending their money on. So, for example, if we're looking at a plant closing, let's say, you know how many workers were at that plant, you know what the supply chain was, you know who's not going to be paid like that. So this is a little bit more complicated, but I think they're mostly looking at consumption spending in this report.
So is that dollar amount something that could be reversed over the next couple of weeks?
I don't know. Again, I think a lot of it is going to be the perception in terms of what's going to happen. You know, if people get their back pay, and I read in, I don't know, one news article today that some people have already gotten like half of their back pay. So it depends on what's their perception of the future. People always spend their money kind of based on where they think they're going to be. And you know, will some people put this aside for a rainy day? You know, I don't know. If they're a little bit higher income, they may be able to do that in case there's another shutdown coming. But for the most part, I think, you know, maybe people have to pay off credit cards right away. And then, you know, it'll go into the economy immediately.
Now, another warning issued by the Congressional Budget Office was that $3 billion of economic activity was permanently lost. Can you do us a favor and break that down for us?
Yeah, I don't know exactly why they're calculating that, but you know, for example, if let's say you were a government worker and you were, you know, you went without pay, so perhaps your food expenditures would be different. You would not be going out to eat, and you know, you get your back pay. You're not going to run down and have two meals at a particular restaurant. So I think that kind of spending is lost for good. I mean, it's just that we won't have that unless, you know, unless they turn around and spend the money on something completely different. So I think the key to some of this is going to be how this ripples through the economy in terms of, you know, what spending was curtailed, what spending was, you know, foregone for good. So, for example, if somebody were in the process of going through a house, you know, buying a house, and all of a sudden they didn't have a paycheck coming in, you know, what happens? Did they lose that deal, and will it take months for them to find another house? Or, you know, I think it's such an individual basis when it comes to that.
Michael Carroll is a professor and the director of the Economic Research Group at the University of North Texas, and we're talking about the long-term effect that the government shutdown may have placed on the U.S. economy. What impact does this permanently lost economic activity have on the country as a whole?
Yeah, so I think overall the amount will be relatively small, or the impact, in other words, if we're looking at how is this going to change GDP, it's going to be relatively small because it wasn't for that long, and the U.S. economy is so big, so diverse that I don't think it's going to be seen in the numbers per se. Now, whether or not some corporations view kind of the dysfunction that brought all of this on as a deterrent, that maybe they'll hold off on investment spending, well, that could be significant because, you know, they may not build a plant for next year. They may not do some other big capital spending. It just depends on how this whole thing is perceived as it goes through the process.
Now, there is certainly a possibility that we may experience another government shutdown if the two sides don't agree. Does that have an effect on the economy depending on how long it goes? We saw how long this one went. Is there a breaking point in terms of if there's another government shutdown, you know, how long that goes before there's a real effect on the U.S. economy?
I think we've kind of reached that point with this last one. I think if it goes beyond a month or a month and a half, especially given the, that we just experienced the one we just finished, then we could definitely start seeing some long-term effects just with, you know, people not going into those particular jobs, the contractors not getting paid, all of the things that would be a consequence of this. I think you could see that. And I think the second one, if there is a second one, I think it'll be more telling.
Now, as far as lawmakers are concerned, the permanent loss of $3 billion maybe in a grand scheme of things may not mean that much for the overall economy, but should it raise flags for politicians in Washington?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I it's very, very bad politically, obviously, for people to be used kind of as a pawn in a game. So I think it definitely does have long-term implications. And I don't know. I know there's been talk about trying to put together a bill or something like that does not allow for the shutdown and continuing resolutions, you know, just automatically get extended in, you know, during the negotiation process, because we've been on continuing resolutions now for years that we just constantly keep funding for a year, a few weeks or months or so at a time.
Now, the government shutdown highlighted another issue, and that is many Americans, not just federal employees, but many Americans across the country are living paycheck to paycheck. Can you talk about what that term means?
Yeah, it just means that, you know, people are spending out of their paycheck. So they get paid, you know, on the first of the month or the whatever. And then by the end of the month, they're out of money. They don't have any significant savings in the bank. So if they disrupt that and they're not getting paid, then they have no income that they can access for their spending. So they end up, if they have availability for, you know, to put it on a credit card or something like that, but that obviously has to be repaid. So you end up spending that, and then you get paid the next time, and you still have your normal monthly expenses. And then now you have to pay the credit card debt for the amount that you had to borrow before. So it kind of has a snowball effect in terms of those kind of families.
We're talking to Michael Carroll. He's a professor and the director of the Economics Research Group at the University of North Texas. He's with us to talk about the effect the government shutdown has had on the economy and what some of the long-term effects could be. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the economics of the shutdown? In what ways do you think this could influence how lawmakers handle shutdowns in the future? Are you concerned that we could see another shutdown in a few weeks? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit right here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner. Right now, we continue our conversation about the economic impact of the government shutdown with Michael Carroll. He's a professor and the director of the Economics Research Group at the University of North Texas. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you were part of the shutdown, what impact did it have on your family and your finances? If you work in an industry like banking, what impact did the shutdown have on your customers? Or you can call in with your questions about how the economy was hurt by the shutdown. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Now, Michael, we were talking about how many of the workers government workers are living paycheck to paycheck, and you talked about how many people are putting a lot of their expenses on credit cards. How does this financial insecurity then impact the economy long term?
It definitely would hurt the economy long term, because you really need consumer confidence to be relatively high, so people feel comfortable of going ahead and making those expenditures, especially if they're for larger ticket items. You know, for example, if they have to buy a new refrigerator or want a new refrigerator, and maybe that would be something that they would defer for a while. So I think it definitely the optimism for the consumer as well as for the business, you know, of the businesses. How are they going to staff? You know, did food retail or, say, tourism, did any of that get scaled back during that time in anticipation? But, you know, this first time around, I don't think anybody knew that it would last as long as it did.
Now, we were talking about the fact that many families during this time has had to take on more debt because they weren't getting paid and they're carrying debt. And because of that, they'll have less disposable income over in the interim. Can we see more ripple effects like this as time moves on? Could this lead to even a possible recession if this keeps up?
Yes, the uncertainty certainly could, because what you need is optimism and things like that to continue this drive, especially in a drive that's been going on for so long. I mean, in terms of the recovery from the Great Recession back in 2009. So I think it does, and I think the specifics are going to be industry to industry. So just for example, what's happening to the childcare industry of the workers that were impacted? You know, did they not send their children to childcare during the shutdown, or did they? And then, you know, a lot of those childcare centers have waiting lists, and I don't know, you know, if they pulled their kids out, do they have to, you know, can they get them back in? So I think on an industry by industry basis, it's going to be kind of interesting to see how everything adjusts.
Well, you bring up childcare, which I thought was a very good point. You know, what other potential fallout that you can think of that we could see on a family level regarding the shutdown?
I think it's the childcare is a big one. Any sort of, you know, schooling that they may have been paying for, and there may have been extracurricular activities that they couldn't afford to pay for. You know, you'd hate to pull someone out of a basketball program, for example, because you couldn't get them to the games or something because they didn't have any income for that. You would hate to see that kind of thing happen on a family basis, but it very well could have. You know, if in fact they are living paycheck to paycheck, all of those kind of things get weighed together, and then you end up having to eliminate the ones that that aren't necessary for you know, just core spending.
Right now, we're continuing our conversation about the economic impact of the government shutdown. Michael Carroll joins us. He's a professor and the director of the Economics Research Group at the University of North Texas. Give us a call. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you work in an industry, whatever that may be, white collar or blue collar, what impact did the shutdown have on you? If you're in an industry where you're a business owner, what effect or what impact did the shutdown have on your customers? You can call in with your questions about how the economy was hurt by the shutdown. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Now, lawmakers have until mid-February to reach a funding agreement. Now, in the event that they don't reach an agreement, what could a second shutdown potentially look like? I know we kind of talked about this before, but take us through what that could potentially be like.
I think you would see similar responses, although I think if a second one occurred, I think people would take it much more serious, because I think, you know, we've had a lot of very short-term shutdowns in the past, you know, something that would literally may have been shut down just over the weekend. And, you know, people make their point, and politicians are able to show that, you know, there was something wrong, and they needed to do that to make a point. But I think this time, if it comes along again, especially given the length of this last one, I think it may have more prominent spending, impacts just on the economy from the federal workers, as well as from you know, government contractors. You know, so for example, maybe contractors would be leery about actually entering into an agreement. They may have, you know, two options. They may be able to work for a private sector firm, or maybe they would work for the government. You know, maybe in the future they would choose the private sector firm, which means then that, you know, the government activities may not be getting the talent that they currently have. So it may do that, and it may also, in fact, affect in the long run just how many government workers stay in the government sector. You know, if they do have opportunities or if they were looking for a job, they may be more willing to leave the job, to leave their current, you know, government job and go into the private sector because they may feel that it was more more stable. Now, generally, that's the opposite. Most people feel that, you know, some of the government jobs are more stable than the private sector jobs, and that's some of the appeal to work it for the government sector. So I think just the perception of how this goes through, and then the fact that, you know, if it really does occur within a few weeks after the first one, I think it could have far more reaching economic repercussions.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Adam in Madison. Good afternoon, Adam. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi. I was calling because this may not be an economic related question or comment, but I'm a doctor and I did not experience any change in my clinic schedule or my surgery schedule from the government shutdown. But I think there's an indirect effect of the shutdown on people's morale just in general in the country. And to know that people are going through this and, you know, as a parent, thinking about kids being withdrawn from their daycares and, you know, missing basketball games and things like that, those are intangibles, hard to measure. But I think they're really important because I think there's some direct effects, you know, just on a week-to-week basis with the parents, you know, trying to keep their kids in their daycare and things like that. But there's also maybe a more long-term effect, too, on what do their children think of their government when they miss the basketball game or when they've been taken out of the daycare or, well, probably not daycare age, but, you know, what are long-lasting societal effects on their view of the government, you know, when they seem to be put as a pawn, as you said earlier in the program? So definitely an intangible. I'm not sure if it relates to today's conversation like you wanted it to, but I just worry about more long-term effects on the psyche and the morale of the American people versus the direct economic effect. So
Adam, thank you so much for the call. You know, Michael, Adam is saying that, you know, basically it didn't affect him, but he saw how it affected others. And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, federal employees because they were directly affected because they weren't getting paid. But I think it's safe to say that people who aren't federal employees were affected by this as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's interesting, his comment, because it made me think back of some of the work that has been done in terms of the economic consequences of recessions. And, you know, if a company or if a country is in a recession, you know, the healthcare rate or healthcare issues, you know, go up. There's more heart attacks. There's been more links to suicides and all of that. In an overall economic sense, there are consequences to that, and labor force participation rates may change. As we said earlier, people may not go into those kind of jobs that would be affected by a shutdown. So I think those are good points.
We've got about a minute left, so unfortunately we can't get to Brian's call, but I will read what he said. He said, this is a super wasteful situation in terms of lost wages. He blames Congress for consistently kicking the can down the road when it comes to the budget. What will you be on the lookout for over the next few weeks when it comes to this?
I think seeing what sort of negotiations that are going on and how close in any common language that the two sides have. You know, are there common points that they can agree on and at least move forward? But again, he was right in the sense that this has been happening more and more often, and we haven't had a straight budget for quite a while.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
Michael Carroll is a professor and the director of the Economics Research Group at the University of North Texas. He joined us today to talk about the impact that the government shutdown had on the economy. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out what has caused this historic frigid weather and whether we should expect it to be the new normal. And we'll ask you to join in with your experiences. Whether it's part of the current decluttering craze or just a desire to make a few bucks, many people are selling belongings online. We'll find out what the pros and cons are of different sites. That's coming up tomorrow, right here on Central Time.